We care about our land more than somebody down in Ottawa.
A land code puts the First Nation into the power of government.
The biggest point for me is your ability to protect your reserves lands.
Former chief of our community had the vision to sign and the guts to sign that framework agreement.
Business at the pace of business.
I think it just proves that First Nations lands management really is working.
The good thing about land code, we don't have to sell it. It sells itself.
This is the Land Decolonized Podcast. I'm Richard Perry. Miko Nicholas has been on a mission since leaving his Tobik First Nation home about 25 years ago, and he spent nearly all of that time with one organization, the First Nations Land Management Resource Center, where he leads the team supporting communities who are taking back full control of their own lands and resources. I spoke with Miko as the Resource Center drew closer to a very important milestone, 100 First Nations that have ratified their own land codes. Here's our conversation. Hey, Miko, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you, Richard. Happy to be here.
I think we've set a first in this series because the host and the guest are actually both in the same time zone. So congratulations.
That's nice. Yes.
Pretty sneaky of you to manage it that way. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah. Funny how that worked out.
So we've had a wonderful time talking with chiefs and other folks across the country about the First Nations Land Management Resource Center, the whole land code process. And when I heard about the experience you had with the organization, I thought, what a great opportunity. So maybe first of all, give us a quick overview of your role within the center, and then we'll backtrack a little bit into your own personal story.
Okay, sure. So I'm the executive director of the Lands Advisory Board Resource Center, or the First Nations Lands Management Resource Center, depending on who you talk to. Yeah, my role. I do a lot of work with the LAB, a lot of managing of the relationship between the Lands Advisory Board, the Resource Center in Canada, really focusing on the implementation of the framework agreement, and then working with my colleagues in the Resource Center in the various areas of expertise to deliver services to First Nations, everything from developmental work to operational implementing land codes, as well as working with interested First Nations. A lot of my role also falls into working with other organizations like the National Aboriginal Lands Managers Association, First Nations Taxation. Even though the framework agreement doesn't deal with taxation, a lot of the work that they do tends to cross over into our area and sometimes vice versa. So we do try to manage a relationship with other Indigenous organizations, including Financial Management Board, the First Nations Finance Authority, and really any organization, even First Nations Market Housing. So there's a fair amount of relationship and to a certain extent coordination with other organizations. We don't want to compete with any other Indigenous organization. We want to make sure that we're complementing and holding up those other organizations.
And there actually seems to be a very strong network of like-minded organizations that are moving, you know, toward self-government, toward more autonomy, more self-control. So that's critical.
Absolutely. I think it makes really a lot less sense for us to be duplicating efforts. So the more we're coordinated, I think the better. And I think we're making more of an effort to be that.
Sure. So you are Maliseet from Tobik First Nation in New Brunswick, correct?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
So take me on the journey back to, before you even became involved at this level, tell me about your growing up years, your coming of age years.
Okay.
You don't have to get into all the detail.
This could be a long story. I'll try to keep it short. I grew up in the Tobik First Nation, Nigukuk-Ulistigwik, First Nation in Tobik in northern New Brunswick. And my parents were involved in education, and my family my larger extended family was very politically inclined. So you kind of grew up with this whole idea of, how do we help our communities, right? You grew up with a very heavy responsibility, to make an effort to make things better. And you grow up hearing about how the Indian Act is such a huge problem. And you grow up hearing, you know, all these ideas as to how we get past it. You know, what does life look like on the other side? What does life look like if we take back our authority, right? And you go to 10 meetings with your parents, even if you're just a kid running around, you still hear people talking very passionately and very openly about the challenges in our communities. And as I mentioned, it almost always comes back to the Indian Act. So you grew up that I grew up with that drilled into my head, basically. Went to university here at UNB in Fredericton, which is only about 2 hours from my community. And after that, I went to Ottawa and didn't have a job, didn't really have anything lined up. All I had was a political science and a psychology degree under my belt. And, you know, you think you knew it all, you know, it all at that age. But I went there and I really didn't have any options. I had some friends and we were, you know, I spent a lot of days pounding the pavement in my one suit that my father had bought for me, trying to find work. A friend of mine suggested that, you know, you open the yellow pages and just start finding First Nations organizations and just start calling them. So that's what I did. And that actually didn't work. I did. zero success in that. One day I was out passing out resumes at the government at Indian Affairs on the north in Gatineau, and a friend of mine said, "Hey, you know, they're accepting resumes up in the minister's office. Why don't you go drop one off there?" I said, "Oh, okay." So I went up there, and a couple of people greeted me when I went, and we just talked. We just sat and we talked for, I don't know, two and a half hours. And we didn't talk about work or really anything. I did leave my resume and I did talk a little bit about, you know, what I wanted to do and what I, you know, want to do in the world and that kind of thing. And, but like I said, we just really just connected, which was nice. There were two really good people, and they said, "Hey, well, why don't you come back on Monday?" And I was like, I was delayed. I was like, "Yeah, absolutely, I'll be here."
Still wearing that same suit, no doubt.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it had to be pretty dirty and smelly. well, regardless, it worked out okay because at the time, I'd been searching for a few months, and I'd actually was thinking about going back and doing my master's at the time. So I got in, with the minister's office and, sort of started, very sort of entry position, working with, the EA, which is, Brad Morse at the time, the EA to Minister Irwin. And, Brad was, you know, really, or is a very brilliant mind. And, I learned quite a lot about him from him about, you know, how things work at Indian Affairs. And it wasn't too long after, you know, Brad asked me to help him with the framework agreement. And, you know, a number of chiefs and First Nations leaders were looking to really promote this idea of replacing the Indian Act lands management sections with First Nations authority. And I thought that was just amazing. That was, to me, that was everything I'd grown up hearing about, you know, these were the solutions. And these were the guys that, or the people, the communities that were really just wanting to move ahead. At the time, it was only 13 communities that were pushing this. This was about 95, I think it was. And that's when I met Rob and Graham Powell and a lot of the other leaders, such as Chief Austin Bear, Bill McHugh. And these guys were just, you know, they were, like I said, everything that I had that thought was, you know, kind of my purpose, right? You know, to help communities with.
And Rob being Robert Louis?
Yes, Robert. Yeah. Yes, Robert Louis. So,
okay, good.
Yeah. So, you know, these were the guys that were just doing it, right? They weren't talking about it anymore. They were saying, "Look, we want to put our heads down and we want to, you know, work with our communities and get them out of the Indian Act. And, you know, this is how we see it happening." So we worked with, you know, from the government side from about 95. Well, I started in about 94, and I left in about 97. And that was when Rob said, you know, "Hey, you know, why don't you come on, you know, come on to this side?" And I said, you know, again, without question, absolutely, I'm there.
Yeah.
So that's how, you know, that's how the journey with the framework agreement started. Is I kind of it was kind of happened by accident as opposed to intention.
What a story, though. I mean, when you went, when you joined up, as you said, there were what, 13 or 14 First Nations that were part of the land code process. And today, I think I'm right in that 1 in 3 First Nations are either signatories in the developmental phase or they've signed on to the list to become more involved.
That's right. We've got quite a list of interested First Nations. We've got about 165 signatories now. So we went from 13 to 165, which is, I think, pretty amazing.
How did you go about, or how did communities find you, I guess? I mean, there you are, you're back in the days before, I think before Facebook and Twitter and social media and the internet generally, I guess. But so how did organizations find you?
That's a really interesting question too, because it was largely word of mouth. You know, there was a lot of misinformation about the framework agreement and and still is. Mm-hmm. But in the early 90s, there was, I think, a fair bit more. And there was an agreement that, you know, both Rob and Austin made with the AFN chief at the time, which basically they said, look, we're not going to go out there and solicit. We never intended to. This agreement was only intended to apply to these 13 First Nations. There was another, so the 13, 14 thing, there was another community added on, I think it was 97 or 98. Mm-hmm. So that's why we bat around that 13 and 14 number. But they said that they would just rely on word of mouth. If a First Nation sought us out, absolutely we would support them. But we would never, you know, you won't see a booth, the Resource Center booth or anything right. at an AFN meeting saying, hey, you know, come do this.
Sure.
It was basically communities, you know, a lot of them, I think, you know, wanted to see what was going to happen, because a lot of folks, you know, said, you know, look, the sky was going to fall, right? If First Nations, you know, took their own authority and moved away from the Indian Act. And that didn't happen. And I think First Nations started to see that. Look, you know, I think that communities are better equipped to deal with governing their own lands than Canada is.
Yeah. Well, you've got some amazing ambassadors across the country, and we've heard from some of them in this series. And when you're dealing with the federal government in particular, what kinds of challenges did you run into whenever there's an election cycle or whenever there's a new minister or sometimes a new deputy minister, which can really throw a wrench into things?
Oh boy, yes. Pretty much the early 2000s, all the 2000s was a lot of upheaval for us. So a lot of folks coming and going, political leaders and staff. So it was starting over each time with people having to kind of really get the point across that this isn't a government program, right? This is an agreement that we've signed, you know, government to government, and we both have responsibilities to First Nations. So, you know, that was a challenge, I would say, in the early 2000s, but hasn't really been since, you know, after 2010, I think the attitude changed quite a bit.
Strategic planning. How do you go about assessing what your people out in the field need and how they should be setting their priorities?
We try to, you know, follow the lead of First Nations. So we have a lot of our staff people in the field. We look at them as our primary relationship advisors of management, because they're the first contact with First Nations. And because this is, you know, a custom, you know, not a one size fits all type of thing, each First Nation has different priorities. So we try to staff professionals behind the people who are in the field to help with that type of advice to communities. So, you know, we could run to a community that doesn't have a land use plan, for example, or doesn't have an emergency plan, or communities that do have those things. Or we have First Nations that run into, when they get to the operational stage, they have a lot of legacy issues. So issues that were left over from the Indian Act management. Mm. And those can be very complicated, and they range from survey problems, survey fabric problems, to environmental issues, to even veterans' lands issues. Like, all kinds of things come out once you start pulling on that thread at the registry system.
Well, I should give a shout out to one of your technicians from your Eastern office, Danielle Alain. Yes. I think she might even be from Tobik.
She is from Woodstock.
Or that area. Woodstock. Yeah. Yes. Woodstock. Thank you. Yeah.
All the communities along the Wolastoqiyik, the St. John River, we were all one community at one time. So we were all one people.
I mean, I was doing communications work with Buckinket Mi'kmaq Nation, east of Anangonish, which is in the developmental phase. And Danielle, for the very first community engagement session, I think she drove 6 hours to get there just to help our lands officer, you know, explain some of the background and history. And God bless her, she came back and did the same thing a few months later. So you've got some really dedicated folks working with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's, I think, one of the things about this place is that, you know, the work is something that the staff really believe in. Like, they're heavily invested in seeing communities, you know, get to that next level, whatever that is for them.
Back to legislation again. The original agreement was back in 96, I think. But as I understand it, you have a priority of either replacing the First Nations Land Management Act or modifying it to some extent. Why is that important?
Well, the current FNLMA has caused a lot of problems. So what it did, it's only the framework agreement, when it was signed in 1996, it contained a commitment for the federal government to ratify it with legislation. So if you compare it to other things like the West Bank Self-Government Agreement, first there was an agreement that was negotiated, and then Canada went and ratified it with legislation. That legislation, that ratifying legislation at West Bank didn't change the original agreement, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same situation here. The framework agreement was signed. That's the guiding document that everybody adheres to and ratifies.
Yeah.
The legislation, however, when it was passed in 1999, it repeated some sections of the framework agreement and left others out. And it used different terms in different places, which caused some people to interpret the framework agreement differently, right? And that was never the intent. The intent was always to have the framework agreement be the guiding piece of document for everybody. So we are looking to replace the FNLMA with a much simpler piece of legislation, something that basically just ratifies the framework agreement, something that doesn't seek to repeat any sections of the framework agreement, and something that just gives notice to other federal law that may be affected by the framework agreement. So those are the only things we're looking for. Something very simple and something very short.
Yeah. So that disconnect, has that been part of the problem where you've seen some myths develop that you've had to take time to correct?
Oh, God, yes. Community after community, you know, there are some people that only look at federal legislation. And if you ignore the framework agreement, you're missing a lot of important content. So the impression that leaves people with is that it is the FNLMA that controls the exercise of the inherent right by First Nations. And that was never the intent. That wasn't the intent of the FNLMA, right? So But the fact that it repeats certain sections, people say, okay, so the FNLMA says this, so we have to do this. And that was basically handed down by Parliament, so we have to follow that. That's not exactly true, right? So that's why we have to correct that. And it's given people who have conspiracy theories about the framework agreement a lot to go on as well, right? So if they see Canada controlling, you know, our governments and the exercise of our inherent rights, absolutely, you know, that does cause people to, you know, to raise an eyebrow. But I mentioned, it's not the case. And that's why we're hoping to change that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You've got a website that is rich in information and detail and has all kinds of training resources. Are you using digital tools more now to try to share some of the stories and correct some misinformation that's out there?
Absolutely. Well, again, we've been a virtual organization for many years. Actually, a lot of our staff have worked from home, as we found that much better than having a central office and asking people to commute, say, in Ottawa or Kelowna or Vancouver or wherever. Again, our focus is on supporting First Nations, and we try to hire staff that have familiarity in different areas, that understand areas of Canada, that understand the First Nations in their area, that have a connection to them, it's even better. And so our tools, our electronic tools, for example, our training and capacity building, there's always been an electronic component to that, because a lot of times we've had people come to us and say, look, we need training, but we can't afford to leave our jobs and enroll in, say, a university level 4-year type of situation.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Even 2 years or 3 years, that's still very difficult for someone who's on the job and needs to find their way around, a tough implementation problem with their land code. So we've always had an electronic component to that. And we've really, I guess, even before COVID, had put a fair amount of emphasis on that. And then COVID came, and then so we just doubled down. We're doing, basically webinars every couple of weeks. We're really spending a lot more time on updating our courses and adding new ones in. We've got 50 online courses right now. We'll probably have another 10 before the end of the fiscal year. And these are courses that anybody can go on our website and take.
I had the good fortune of attending a land code conference, I think a couple of years ago in Winnipeg, and something really interesting was to watch the mentorship between chiefs who've had a lot of experience with land code talking to some who are just learning now. Like I remember seeing, I think, Jeremy Norman and from Flying Dust First Nation in Saskatchewan, Jerry Duquette Jr. from Doak East in Ontario, talking with new people, pardon me, and sharing the information. And what a wealth of wisdom that people can tap into at no charge.
Absolutely. The material is 100% based on the experiences of First Nations. And that is what gives this everything credibility, right? Is the experience of communities that are out there actually, exercising their governance authority over the lands and resources. So they're the ones that we learn from.
This might be one of the myths that you were talking about. A lot of communities have outstanding land claims. Some communities are still active with ATR or addition to reserve. And does that impact the land code process, or would the land code provide an umbrella around any and all future lands brought into the community?
Well,
I'm not sure if I've asked that in the right order, but I think you see what I'm getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. I get the gist. So the framework agreement doesn't affect treaties. It doesn't affect any outstanding claims to territories beyond reserve or anything to that extent. It was really just set up to take back land governance authority. It wasn't intended to deal with claims or anything. So, gotcha. When a First Nation has a claim or an ATR or a TLE or something going on with Canada, that's in a separate track. And a lot of times what happens is that once those lands and those separate tracks become reserve, they can be added to the authority of the First Nation under their land code, as long as they're reserve land. If they're not reserve land, then they generally can't.
Okay, good. Thanks for clearing that up in my head anyway. I'm sure others have a clear sense of that. One of the interesting things is that from my point of view as someone involved in media over the years is that you're working in quite a legal framework. You're dealing with legislation, you're dealing with laws, and yet you still have to tell stories to get your message across. How difficult has that been over the years to translate legal stuff into layman's terminology?
Well, that again, another big challenge. I mean, when we work with communities to develop land codes, for example, we always recommend that First Nations start with a committee of some sort, a cross-section of people from the community, and that the land code is drafted in the simplest language possible. One of the reasons for that is because if it's drafted by a lawyer or drafted by someone in the legal profession, it can be unintelligible to the layperson, right? So when First Nations people see things that aren't clear, of course we get suspicious by things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's why the land codes need to be absolutely crystal clear and very drafted in the most understandable form possible. And how easy has it been to translate? Well, there are some First Nations that have obviously a greater emphasis on legal, on more legal type drafted documents and instruments and that type of thing. But so we always say, we always bring those examples with caution. So we say, look, so-and-so First Nation, you know, has developed a lease that has this type of language. You should probably run that through your own legal folks first instead of just taking it and dropping it in, that type of thing. So we always kind of just try to add a caveat to anything we say, you know. So we do, I mean, as you said earlier, this is really based on like a collective experience. So First Nations coming into this were never intended to sort of be on their own, that they were always supposed to draw on the experience of other communities. And other communities have been very gracious in sharing their experience. And again, with the caveat that, you know, you just can't usually just drag and drop something that, you know, there's some customization that's usually involved.
Well, yeah, you're right. And I remember the first time going into YouTube and just doing a generic search for land code, First Nations in Canada, and the number of different communities that have produced videos, it really took me back. I thought, you know what, this has to be some kind of coordinated communication strategy.
Well, the funny thing is it wasn't. To a certain extent, I mean, there are a lot of communities that in the developmental phase that just use video as a means of informing their people. Because, you know, again, just plunking, you know, volumes of information, of written information in people's laps usually doesn't work very well, right? So we've had to be kind of innovative in that way and support communities that want to do that kind of thing. As well as give them examples of other communities that have as well. So I can't say it was really coordinated, but I think it's just sort of recommended as a general good practice, right?
Yeah, it's organic and it seems to be working. So yeah, that's awesome. Just to wrap up, Miko, where to from here? Where does the organization go next?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I mean, we've got a strategic plan. It's funny. I mean, throughout the 2000s, we weren't really super strategic, I would say. We were very reactive. Throughout the last 10 years or so, that's kind of changed. And I think that, you know, our relationship with Canada has meant that the framework agreement is very well supported. And I think that Canada supports the addition of even more First Nations to the framework agreement. So from where I sit, we've got approximately, as you said, 20% First Nations that have either already joined the framework agreement or are interested. There very well could be, you know, another, you know, 50 or 100 in the next, 10, 15 years. What does that look like? I don't really know. Only that, you know, we're doing our best to support communities. And, our goal is to be the best resource for First Nations as we can be and try to maintain a certain level of service.
Sure thing. If there's a lands officer somewhere listening to this for the first time and wants to get in touch with you or some other contact, what's the best route for them to take?
Well, our website is probably the best. I mean, we've got like a contact us, but we've also got a list of everybody who works at the RC and their, you know, their emails and their phone numbers and everything. So I like to think we're pretty easily accessible, and definitely we are open to anybody who wants to contact us, really.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a real treat, Miko, all the way from that story about your one suit to the expansion of a national organization and the impact you're having in communities from coast to coast to coast. So I really want to thank you for your time.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Richard.
The Land Decolonized podcast is brought to you by the First Nations Land Management Resource Center and is supported by the Lands Advisory Board. For up-to-date information on the Land Code, including governance tools, training materials, and much more, visit labrc.com. That's labrc.com. I'm Richard Perry. Thank you for listening.